Climb aboard the SS Venture, don your island exploring clothes, and join us for another monkey knockout gassing episode this week as we finally get to a Western filmmaker taking Daikaiju seriously. We are diving into the world of Peter Jackson's pet project in the form of yet another remake of the original Eighth Wonder of the World. Tune in and buckle up, for this is Kaiju vs. History, King Kong.
Welcome back to Kaiju versus History. This is your Fey-Ray screaming stand-in Patrick, and joining me as a new screenwriter character added for seemingly no reason is Miles. Hey, Miles.
Hey. I actually like that twist. Let's be perfectly honest.
Yeah, it's so funny, and we're going to talk about it all night long. But there's so many things that are done to the letter of like the original film and the original kind of concept of the movie. And there's so many changes made by Peter Jackson. And, you know, there's some new characters which were added in. We're talking about 2005's King Kong tonight. King Kong.
Yeah, this is definitely a movie that I had not seen since theaters before doing this podcast. And I actually hadn't seen since theaters before doing this episode. So yeah. I was really excited to get back to it because I remember seeing this like at midnight when it came out, not knowing it was 3 hours long.
Oh, yeah. Well, I knew Peter Jackson directed this. So I remember looking before I went to the theater. I was like, oh, it's one of these. Okay. It's like Return of the King. Got it.
Yeah, but I guess before we just get into this, because I know there's a lot to go over, and this is a big whopping movie. Mm-hmm. Tell us, Patrick, what, if anything, is in the title? Because this one I'm probably pretty cut and dry, right?
This is our third film that is called King Kong, and you know I hate it when they just use the same title over and over again. But yeah, this is the second remake after. You know, this monkey's been around for over 70 years. And I mean, King Kong was just a cultural milestone. I would say in the West, much bigger than Godzilla, even though Godzilla was huge.
Nowadays, not so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Now Godzilla's got a firm footprint in the Americas and
the true king Europe. Of the monsters.
But yeah, it's such a cultural lightning rod. That when the film was remade for the first time in the 70s, we had like four different giant monkey knockoff movies. And yeah, this is the official second big budget live action remake of the 1933 RKO film. And this one, I was very excited when I first saw the trailers, probably back in 2004, that what is going to be, it was a period piece. And it was basically taking what from the trailer looked like the exact same story and giving it a Hollywood paintbrush, giving it a Peter Jackson fresh off of Lord of the Rings, you know, stab at it. And it looked beautiful. It looked amazing. Mm-hmm. Peter Jackson had just won, I think, an Oscar, a couple of Oscars for The Return of the King. So as hot as he has ever been. So this movie you will often hear described, I guess the 70s one is often called De Laurentiis's King Kong, or, you know, King Kong of that year. Was it 1976? 76 King Kong. This is almost exclusively, I think, referred to as Peter Jackson's King Kong because.
And rightly so.
Yeah. Yeah. He was just so hot, and we'll go into it in a little bit, but this really was. His baby is a film that he spent over a decade developing, which is crazy, but
I love the story that, like, you know, after the Frighteners, you know, Universal wanted to, you know, keep this guy. And so they offered him a chance to remake Creature of the Black Lagoon, which I would have loved to have seen. They've been kicking around the potential Creature remake for a long time. I know at one point, I think it was Breck Eisner, the guy who did Sahara. He was in talk. To do it, because it was like right around that time that Sahara came out, because I think they were even possibly wanting McConaughey to star in it.
Yeah, they missed out. They could have had Del Toro win an Oscar for them.
I know. So he turned down, Jackson turned down Creature, and then somebody, I guess, had told somebody else in the executive office that Jackson was obsessed with King Kong. And
yeah,
they offered that to him, which he initially declined, but then was like haunted by the idea that someone else would completely screw up King Kong. And yeah, he was like, so he had to say, he's like, if anyone's going to mess this up, it's going to be me.
Peter Jackson isn't just a fan of the 1933 King Kong. It is very possible he is the world's largest King Kong fan. It is the movie that he said in multiple interviews inspired him to become a filmmaker. He referenced the film in his movie Brain Dead, I think his mm-hmm. first feature film. One of his very early films.
It's one of his early 80s. New Zealand films. I don't know if that's his.
The monkey in that movie that spreads the infection is said to come from Skull Island. He also has one of the original or one of the largest collections of original Kong memorabilia in the world, and one of, I think, only two surviving King Kong armatures from Willis O'Brien's, you know, special effects workshop, the actual model miniature armature that was used for, I don't think like the fur and things have survived, but the metal skeleton has. And I mean, I'm sure he has like a ton more stuff, but yeah.
Yeah. Bad Taste and Beauty the Feebles came before Brain Dead.
He started. Yeah. They were filming Frighteners in 1995. I think he started to go into production for King Kong in 96, writing scripts, which sounded bananas, honestly, pun intended, with his wife, who I think is now mostly his co-producer for films. And they were banging something out. And like I said, we're ready to go into production. They were looking at leads, thinking maybe Kate Winslet or Minnie Driver for the Ann Darrow's type character. She was very different in that original script. And looking for, as lead actor, maybe George Clooney, which I think in the late 90s would have been, you know, probably a pretty hard get. But
I could see Clooney in that movie.
Him and Kate Winslet, I think, would have made a good pair. But also, wildly, Robert De Niro was one of the names that's
for what? For Carl?
I guess, but
it couldn't be for anything else.
If it was for the main lead, that would have been like a 30-year age difference between De Niro and Kate Winslet. So it
never stops anyone before, but still, yeah, exactly. Like,
but yeah, they went into production. They started to get cold feet, and Harvey Weinstein, who they were working with for Lord of the Rings, I think started to say, we're only going to do one of these Lord of the Rings movies if we're going to do it. And they're like, no, let us make all three. And then we'll do them all, and it'll save a lot of money, cause you don't have to like continuously ship people across the world.
Right. Cause they made all three of those movies for $300 million, right?
Yeah. And they filmed them over the course of a year and a half, but Universal got cold feet for the King Kong, mostly because they heard that TriStar was already going to do a Godzilla movie for release around the same time. This Kong movie was supposed to come out in 1998. And then also Disney was doing another Giant 8 movie.
Yeah.
Mighty Joe Young. So they were going to push it back. And Peter Jackson said, yeah, I can't wait, you know, that long, 1999, maybe, to start filming, or 98 to start filming. So he started production on Lord of the Rings, and that took up like 5 years of his life. Yeah.
And history was made.
He
made three of the greatest fantasy movies of all time.
trilogy of films ever made. And Godzilla 1998 happened in that time, and he really dodged a bullet if it was going to be anything like that. Honestly, that original script he wrote was pretty bonkers. It was a period piece, but Ann Darrow in the film was not an actress. She was going to be like the granddaughter of a you know, paleontologist or a primatologist that was studying Kong. And there are a few other changes, but
I think that could be interesting. I don't think you have to be married to, at this point, to the original script for King Kong.
Yeah.
But, that said, I I like the kind of, oh, let's do King Kong for real. I like the approach of the 2005 movie, where it's like, no, let's make a big budget version of the original story, but I'm gonna adapt my version of that original story. And I do like that take.
We basically just got something so similar in Godzilla Minus One, in doing a new original take on the monster, but also a period piece that really harkens back to the 19 film. And I think this works in similar ways. I think Peter Jackson might have bit off more than he could chew with this one. I think it's one of those things, he's so close to it, I don't think he could see the flaws of the movie. Anyway, we'll get to that.
And the weird thing is, like, there are some noticeable flaws in this movie, but, like, at the same time, like, there are things that he does that I think is incredible. Like, I love the extended exposition. I really love introducing everything at once, in terms of, like, I love Anne's story. Getting her kind of origin, you get to see the kind of person she is, and just making her such a sympathetic heroine. And then also at the same time, you get this down his luck director who we don't see completely as a skeez ball yet. I like that we get this kind of slow build to, oh, he's not really a good guy.
Yeah, well, they start out like putting him up against these executives that he's having to prove himself to. And he is shown as being like kind of the auteur one with morals, right, compared to them. And then we get to the island and he's like,
he is just as bad, if not worse.
Yeah, he's purposely filming all these acquaintances' deaths with a plum, unblinking eye. And I don't know what Peter Jackson is trying to say about his art form as director, but
I think he's talking about the machine of corporate filmmaking, which, I mean, he captures pretty well here.
I mean, he's not... Denham is like the opposite. He's like the adventurer filmmaker.
He's the adventurer too, but he wants to be part of that machine. Like,
yeah, he's Denham, very exploitive as well.
Yeah, Denham never wants, he doesn't want to be the auteur. He's the auteur because he thinks it's going to make him money. And well, then
it's confusing though, because I sympathize so much more with 1933's Denham, that the line he delivers, the last line of the film, makes sense and is a little sad as well. In this movie, I'm like, I don't really trust anything you have to say, Jack Black. Like,
right.
Supposedly, he wasn't supposed to give that line.
He wasn't. It was supposed to be Fay Wray.
Yeah, yeah. And she declined joining up this movie because she didn't want to, like, kind of mix people's ideas about the original and this one.
The story I've heard is that she was softening on the idea, but by the time it came to shoot, she had already passed away.
Oh, that's a shame. But it is an interesting take on the original movie, which was, I would say, pretty light on themes and kind of deep running undercurrents for the movie. It is very much an action adventure movie, which a lot of people will ascribe more importance to, but I don't think that Miriam Cooper and all of them had a lot of malicious intent in their depiction of Kong, depiction of the natives. I think it was just kind of the way filmmaking was going back then, that all that stuff that we now attribute to be very problematic was part of the film.
Well, and they bring that up even in that initial meeting where he's like, oh, I want to see those big swinging breasts of the natives. And
that's what people want to see. Well, and that's funny, because that's what Miriam Cooper was known for, was making kind of documentary pictures of these far off lands. And so I guess was the character of Carl Denham at the time. But yeah, that's the same character we get here. Cooper is a character in this story because there's a throwaway line of Denham saying that Fay Wray can't be in the picture because she's filming with Marion Cooper, which is, it's funny, but it's like, wait a minute.
Oh yeah, no, he's, I think he just says, does he say Faye Ray or does he say, just say Ray?
Yeah, whoever, however she's referenced. Yeah,
they, yeah, they, I liked that. And I mean, there's so much that, I mean, really until we get to the island that I think is great. I love, you kind of alluded that you weren't super into it. I love the Jack Driscoll character. I like that he's kind of tricked into being part of this adventure. I love Adrian Brody. I think he's a great actor. I think he's great in this role. I don't think he's written completely, and which is unfortunate because he's so good in it. I think all the writing that Jackson really gave to mostly was to Kong and Naomi Watts. Naomi Watts, yeah, who is perfectly cast in this movie.
Yeah, she's great. She was kind of unknown to me at the time, but obviously she's done a ton of stuff.
Oh, see, since. I had known her from like Mulholland Drive and The Ring at that point.
Oh yeah, I guess she was in those. I don't remember like seeing her in like huge things until this, and then it seemed like she was everywhere. She was in
She was in I Heart Huckabees as well.
I was about to say I did love I Heart Huckabees. That would be so much fun.
And oh yeah, and she was 21 Grams as well.
I've never seen that, but yeah, she was in I Heart Huckabees the year before this.
Yeah, I mean, she's a phenomenal actress. I'm a huge fan of Naomi Watts, and obviously from the aforementioned like Mulholland Drive and The Ring, big movies for me. But I think I
like that they add in characters here, and I like Adrian Brody as an actor. Normally, I guess I'm a little confused as to why they shuffled names up. Like, he's playing Jack Driscoll, who was the first mate of the Venture in the 1933 movie.
Mm-hmm.
That character is now, the first mate of the ship is now Ben Hayes, and the equivalent of this in the film is the square-jawed actor Bruce Baxter, who's also added in, who's a great addition. But it's like, why not make a new name for the writer character if you're going in and adding in new characters all over the place? It just seems weird.
Kyle Chandler is great as Bruce Baxter.
Yes, like, Kyle Chandler is amazing.
He can go back to coach Friday Night Lights, but like this right here, he understood the assignment in the tone of his character, and he just plays it perfectly.
Kyle Chandler, who is basically kaiju royalty because he'll star in another couple of films, and to my knowledge is like, you know, besides team up movies, he has been in a King Kong only film and a Godzilla only film. He's one of the few actors I feel like that has ever gets pulled that distinction. Off that duology of films. He also was in Godzilla versus Kong, so he starred in one that had both of them, even though he's in that movie for 60 seconds.
Yeah. The one that's weird about, not the one thing, something that's weird about this movie is how a lot of the crew members are a little underwritten for a 3-hour movie. Like Billy Elliot, what's his real name? Jimmy Bell.
That's his name.
But Billy Elliot is there for, I don't want to say no apparent reason, because like, well, I see what he's there for.
No, I don't understand it. I don't understand.
They just don't write it. I like that the character's there. I like what they...
He's like one of our top four main characters in the movie at one part of the film.
Yeah.
Like they give him so much screen time. He's one of like the only four that survive falling into the spider pit, which we'll talk about in great detail soon. But I was watching this movie with my wife and she looked over and she's like, what is Billy Elliot doing in this movie? Like that's how much, you know, power he has on screen, and
he's very, very good. And
I think the original script had more for him, and I thought more was filmed, but I went back and looked at the footage that was in the extended cut, which wasn't that much. It was only 14 minutes somewhere in there, and it just wasn't there. Like his backstory, or like, he disappears after 2/3 of the film. He's not in the New York sequence at the end, right? At all?
No, I don't think so. You might see him popping on the background, I think. I think I did clock him somewhere. But like, to know real thing. And this is what I think is the problem with this movie. really, is that you have 3 hours and 7 minutes theatrical time. Yet somehow you have an ensemble of phenomenal actors, many of whom feel undercooked. And yes, this movie is called King Kong, and we spend some time with King Kong. But the problem is you have all this stuff that I feel like Jackson wants us to feel about these adventurers. He wants to give us a complete pulp experience, because there are some times where this is a just a masterstroke of pulp adventure. And yeah, the writing really isn't there for these characters.
And I would say the pacing as well. There's some pacing issues that, like, the movie really kicks into gear when it gets, obviously when it gets to the island, but that takes like over half an hour, 45 minutes to get there.
I'm okay with that. I like everything until we get to the island. I think all that is banger city for me.
If the movie was an hour and a half, I feel like I might agree with you, because it's so, like, you have a full hour and 10 minutes in the middle that is almost all climax. It's all rising action. It gets crazier and crazier with more monsters trying to eat all the crew. And then finally get this huge fight, this huge kaiju fight with the V-Rexes, which we'll talk about, and King Kong. And then we have like deep decline in action as they go back to New York, and then, you know, arise to the actual climax. It's very oddly. I feel like if he had done it today, he would have divided this into two films, maybe,
which I don't want.
Yeah, but it does feel odd. And it's something I don't think the original had a problem with, because it moved along at such a fast clip.
Yeah, it was the original wasn't even 2 hours long.
It was. I think it was 2 hours long. It is an hour and.
It is.
Hour and 4 minutes. So hour
104 minutes.
140. Yeah. So, I mean, a pretty.
No, standard. 104. And that's with overture. So 100 minutes solid. So an hour 40.
Yeah.
Pretty standard movie time.
Yeah. Hour 40 is pretty standard. We talked a lot about the cast, except maybe the most important cast member, and I think one that a lot of people were surprised about, in Jack Black's casting.
I thought you were about to start talking about Andy Serkis, because I'm like, that's the most important cast.
No, Andy Serkis, oh my gosh, he's so good. But I don't think Jack Black was really he was not the superstar he is now. He was very popular, but, you know, he was
still a rising star then. I don't think we maybe Shallow Hal had just come out. Tenacious D's first album was still doing pretty well. So he was kind of just coming into his stardom.
Yeah, and doing kind of. Yeah. Oh, no. School of Rock had come out.
Yeah, so, School of Rock come out. Orange. Like
that's his like main, like major role before this, I would say, where that Shallow Hal is him starring in a film. He'd been in a lot of great stuff, but like, it just seems like such an odd get for this role. Cause you know, it's asking a lot. It is one of, like, I would say the three main characters of this movie.
It's a kind of casting decision that I love. And it's one that I love for Black, because he's another one of the guys, if you ask him to act, he can do it. And I think he does, no matter how I feel about Carl in this movie, Jack Black knocks it out of the park 100%.
Yes. Yeah. He, I think, just kind of slips into that role so well. And there is a lot of humor stuff for him to do in the role as this kind of schlubby director, slimy director. But I kind of do wish the character was written a little bit more sympathetically, in the same way that we get the actor who played Denim in the original movie getting a more sympathetic kind of version in the Mighty Joe Young movie years later, where it's like best intentions of bringing him back and then things go awry. But yeah, the entire time he just keeps slipping and slipping, and it's harder to like his character. I was just looking on the old Wikipedia. Apparently this role was nominated for like a Teen Choice Award for like best villain of the year, which is kind of funny, but
I mean, did not undeserved.
Well, let's talk about the creatures. Let's talk about the features here. And we've already talked about one in the form of King Kong, and
who looks fantastic. A great design.
Yeah.
Beautifully rendered. The mocap stuff by Andy Serkis is phenomenal.
Yeah. And obviously he had already done Gollum and received so many awards for that. I think this takes it to another level because he is not allowed to use his voice really as Kong. I mean, he probably did when he was like pseudomating and stuff, but he gives so much emotion. I think because he has to act with his eyes, his facial gestures, and his body movements, he has to do so much more than when he's, you know, doing a character that he has to speak with as well. I love this Kong. This is one of my favorite Kongs because it turns it not just into an animal, you know, like a living animal that you really sympathize with for that reason, but a character as well who has a very fun relationship with Ann Darrow in this movie. Like they have some good humor, and it's so crazy to pull that out of Naomi Watts on a green screen, massive green screen with, I shared this picture with with Miles, but Andy Serkis and his get up for he actually did triple duty in this movie because he was on set in like kind of a black monkey like suit to act alongside the actors. He also did the mocap for the Kong model, but then he also plays
the cook
Lumpy.
Yeah.
In the film. So he's just all over this. He is really the MVP of this entire film.
Serkis is phenomenal. There's that really famous photo of him doing the mocap where he's like reaching his hand out. You see it in a lot of movie books and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably on the Wikipedia entry as well. That it's just a really famous photo. It used to be in all the magazines when they're talking about what went into making this character. And I agree. This is one of my favorite Kongs, maybe slightly undercut by the current MonsterVerse Kong.
MonsterVerse is really good.
I also think that this Kong happens because, or the current Kong happens because we had this version of the 2005, because there's so much in the MonsterVerse Kong that I think comes from this depiction of Kong.
I'm going to go one step further and say like all kaiju after this is really elevated and is asked to do more because of this performance.
I mean, the performance, yes, but
definitely
I mean,
the MonsterVerse, I think. Well, to be fair, Andy Serkis was also a producer for the motion capture of some of the early MonsterVerse films. I think he helped with Kong Skull Island. So I think this performance is what's going to honestly give the verisimilitude of moving away from guy in a suit to your CGI, because it's still technically a guy in a suit, you know, on the end of the motion capture suit, but that is digitized.
I mean, I would say that if they were all doing motion capture stuff, well, which yeah, they're not
all. And sometimes they purposefully don't do it, like in Godzilla Minus One, two great effects as well. So
yeah,
it's not the only monster in this movie though, Miles. We got a ton of others. I talk about the V-Rex, the Statosaurus Rex, which means Ravager Lizard King. What do you think of V-Rexes?
I think like on screen, it's a good looking creature. I don't love the design personally.
Yeah, the snarled tooths. It's just like it's trying too hard in that respect.
Well, it also feels a little, it's got a little bit of like, we have Jurassic Park at home feel to it.
Yeah.
In its design, it is, I mean, a good looking creature on screen. I will not say it's not. And the fight is great.
There are a couple of CGI monster effects in this movie that are honestly so horrifying. They are so realistic looking. Mm-hmm. Even something as simple as the Botodon, this like 10 times larger crocodile monster that has this chase scene with Anne at one point. It looks so good. It looks so realistic. This is the same style of dinosaur that Legendary Pictures would use for Doug, the basis for Doug in the Godzilla versus Kong movie is the first since yeah. Doug. I love them here. Did you have a favorite monster or something you want to bring up?
Not a favorite monster as much as like just the sequence with it's also got one of the funniest scenes in it. I thought the insects were great, especially the ones that were on Adrian Brody. It also has the funniest scene because like Jamie Bell is supposed to be shooting these things off and is doing so with sniper precision, despite the fact that he's waving this Tommy gun around like a maniac.
He also closes his eyes at one point and like looks away when he's shooting. I was like, how is Adrian Brody not dead?
Yeah, no, he should have hit him 1,000 times. Like, that scene is hilarious to me because of how stupid it is. But those insects look great. I mean,
one of the hardest to watch scenes in the entire movie. You understand that Peter Jackson is a horror director first and foremost, and then then he did all the Lord of the Rings stuff. My gosh, it's stressful to watch even today. You know,
no, it really is, and I'm glad I watched it by myself because Krista has a phobia of like spiders and stuff. So this house.
Arachna claws, I think, are arachna claws is how they're described here. There's large spider beasts that and the skull crawlers, which would come in Kong Skull Island.
Mm-hmm.
These were all in the original version of the work print of the 1933 King Kong film. There was a sequence when the log tips over in that movie that a bunch of them are killed by these giant spider-like things, and some of the models that were supposed to be in that were reused in other films. I think we talked about them on the podcast previous, but it was, I think, so disturbing or inappropriate that they cut it before the movie came out. I think they got some complaints about it. And the fact that Peter Jackson was like, you know what, let's go ahead and traumatize some children who watch this film. And the Lumpy getting like slowly eaten by these slug parasite worm things is so gross. I love how Adrian Brody just has a couple of like giant crickets on him and he's getting all the Tommy gun help and they're not shooting slugs off a Lumpy.
I know. The ones that don't look great are the stampeding brontosauruses.
You know, I have the opposite memory from watching this in the theater. I was like,
me too.
That looked so amazing on the big screen. And it just doesn't work 20 something years later now.
Almost. You know, I was talking about this with my roommate and because he had recently watched this movie and I'm wondering if it's the type of dinosaur that was the problem. You have these rubbery necked dinosaurs, and with that kind of CGI, it just the uncanny valley takes over. Because I mean, it's not that it's an inaccurate shot; it's just that because they're such kind of wild, wiggling creatures that it just doesn't work.
Yeah,
and I think it's less. I think it's more because they're these like elongated necks and everything, and they're stumbling around. I think it makes it look fake, but you know what I mean? The render just doesn't look good, despite the fact there's probably nothing wrong with how those things are actually done digitally. It's just how they are visually in that scene.
Yeah, I really think it's one of the reasons why we are doing this podcast, but I think seeing this on the big screen, seeing these things like almost life size, if not like a little bit larger, mm-hmm. like just tricks the brain into believing them more. And it's one of the reasons why if you see Jurassic Park on the big screen, it is a completely different experience than watching it at home.
It's great.
And it's one of the reasons why in general movie theaters are still so important, especially for effects heavy stuff like kaiju films.
I will say, I think it also with this specific scene, it also has to do with we were watching this on the big screen in 2005. Mm-hmm. When we really hadn't seen something like this as much.
The CGI here was so far ahead of its time.
Right. So we forgave a scene like this because, you know, it's in the midst of some of the best CGI we'd ever seen.
But it is one of the first like huge usages, I feel like, of special effects in an extended period in this movie. And it was supposed to, I think, be the setup shop. And like I said, I remember in the theater it being a completely different experience.
Oh, I do too.
Almost, you know what I will say? I think almost every sequence that has a human with moving in front of and behind of CGI elements in this movie suffers. But when there are only CGI elements, like Kong versus the V-Rexes, that looks so good still. I feel like, I mean, it's so crazy. We're only 7 years after Godzilla 1998, and I feel like we're 20 years ahead special effects wise.
Well, I mean, I definitely see what you're saying, because largely I agree with you. There's a sequence of Kong carrying Anne around the jungle, and it just doesn't look that great.
Yeah.
The way she's kind of being jerked around some points, like there's a couple of sequences that just for me don't work as well when he's swinging her around. I think because like they have her going a certain direction, even though she probably should be going the other direction. Mm. And it's just some of that stuff, like you said, where you have a human and the CGI doesn't always work. The stampede scene we were talking about, you know, where they're trying to run in between the legs of some of these creatures, it looks good, but you're still like, okay, this is where the barrier is kind of thinning for me.
They're also, I mean, that whole sequence, it would have been fine if it was just the Brontosaurus stampede, but there's also like raptors like eating crew members honestly, at the same time.
If I had the choice, I would have cut this entire sequence.
Well, you know what they did? They cut another sequence that is only in the extended version of the film of the crew taking lashed together like rafts across a river or a swamp and getting attacked by a giant piranha kind of kaiju fish and other bugs, which is like, okay, I understand why they cut it, because like really would have spoiled the surprise for the insect valley. But yeah, of those two, actually, I think I would cut the Brontosaurus as well, because just so many of the elements don't work well
that and we've talked about how, I mean, this is a 3-hour movie and it's got some pacing issues. I think this sequence slows the movie down really, really badly.
It is like, it's very long. Yeah. It's like five, six minutes of like, them just running away.
Not only that, but you have to have the discovery. It's this whole thing. It's like, no, let's just get back to the beach. Let's get to New York. So it's that is a struggle for me. I also narratively, I dislike how we get from, we're on the island, we're not super happy about it because it's messed up our ship, and then we get mystery natives who just kill and take. I kind of wish there was that classic interaction there where you see more of a cultural exchange and not just, oh, it's the mysterious natives and they're just slaughtering people. Mm-hmm. I didn't jive with that as much. Once you have Anne on the sacrificial altar, and it goes from there, I'm fine. But like getting to that point, I honestly didn't love that interpretation of it.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, say what you will about retroactively kind of examining 33's King Kong. They hired folks of color to represent folks of color on like the islands. It's not it's a terrible depiction of natives, but it's so crazy that it wasn't white people in blackface back then.
Yeah, and like I think the little girl is a little white girl that's just got dirt on her.
Yeah, there's plenty of like odd simulated brown face in this film. It reminded me of it's King Kong versus Godzilla that also had a lot of Asian people. And the natives are not a huge part of the plot. Kind of feel like a little bit of their stuff was skipped over. And it's a shame because it is one of the big mysteries of the movie. It's like, well, there's this island with this massive wall on it. Who built it and why? Yeah. There is a lot to love about this movie. And I feel like super negative.
I'm being super critical only because it's a long, long movie and there's a lot to love and I don't want to just gush about it.
Well, what is your favorite part of the movie?
Oh man. There's some funny moments in this movie when Anne is having a conversation with Kong and she's trying to let him know what beautiful means and then just points to herself and goes, beautiful. And I'm like, okay, Anne, calm down.
I mean, Naomi Watts isn't wrong.
Doesn't matter. Funny. That's true.
It is funny. Script wise. It's like, why don't you point to like the sunset or like a flower or something, you know?
Right.
It's so easy.
so funny. And she does it without a hint of like self-awareness. She's just like, no, this is a fact. Yeah. And I mean, I mean, it is, but at the same time, I don't know.
You're an out of work actress. How beautiful are you?
Well, I mean, because she was a poor person, so it's not like she can't be beautiful. I also love when they bring the stage show to New York and Calm comes out and sees the fake Andero and just looks at her in disgust.
Yeah.
And kind of turns his nose. He's like, ugh. It's like the humor in this movie is so good. I do think this movie is gorgeously shot. I love like that sequence where she calls herself beautiful. I actually love that whole bit where like Anne is like using her kind of Follies background, her vaudeville mm-hmm. background, and entertaining Kong. And
yeah,
unfortunately, Kong is a fan of the slapstick where people get hurt, and so like she keeps having to fall and get hurt to make him laugh. But it's such a genuine scene. Like the stuff that gets to the heart of Kong is the best stuff in the movie to me, because like it's him being a character is so important that he's not a monster. And yep. that is one thing that Peter Jackson absolutely understands about the King Kong story.
Yes.
And
I don't think the original film quite put that forward. It is something that obviously De Laurentiis explored in the 76 King Kong. It's basically just a living creature that is more human than, you know, a lot of people would have thought. They see a giant monkey and expect a monster, and it's not what he is.
And the exploration of that was probably some of my favorite stuff. What about you?
My favorite part of this movie is not in this movie, and it is tied to the giant insect sequence, but part of the extended DVD and special effects stuff that Peter Jackson did for the film is he went back and recreated the insect scene, the lost footage from the 33 film and the spider pit for the DVD. But the production crew that did this limited themselves to only using techniques that the 1933 film crew had access to. And he said it was one of the most difficult parts about making the film was doing like the silver screen kind of backwards projection and some of these other, you know, lost techniques. But yeah, you can see it on the DVD. I don't own the extended version, which I probably should, but I remember it coming out because I was like, oh, is Peter Jackson just going to do an extended version of every film he makes from now on? And pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't think the Mortal Engines has an extended cut, does it?
He didn't direct that. But
what am I thinking of?
I mean, he produced it. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, he produced it. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think he did. Honestly, he's not directed that much outside of six Hobbit films, six films set in the world of the Rings.
Yeah, his last I think directorial movie was the last Hobbit movie. He did a documentary, but
yeah, he's done a couple of documentaries. He did the Beatles ones, but yeah,
I think he's doing another one of those.
I always forget he did direct The Lovely Bones, but that felt a departure. And I don't know, maybe they just give him like the biggest adaptations.
I'm sorry, he did write the Mortal Engines. That's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, it was an adapted screenplay because it was based on a book. I liked that movie. It's so weird. It's
I still never saw it. It looked fun.
Yeah, I all it needs is a giant monster for these big old cities to fight and add it to the list, but it did so poorly.
I remember that movie bombing.
This movie, though, in a very similar way to that one, at the time set a record for the number of visual effect shots that it had. 2,400 is what the count I'm looking at. So much worked super well in this movie. I really do feel like this is a 10 out of 10 King Kong movie, a perfect 10 out of 10 for Peter Jackson. I feel like this is the movie that, you know, for better or worse, he had like final cut of the film. There's no one telling him like, hey, maybe you should shave off a half hour No, he got to put out the movie that he wanted.
Well,
he got
I
to
mean,
put out the extended cut that he wanted.
At the same time, he had just done those Three Rings movies. So who was going to stop him?
Well, I think you part know? Of his original deal, even before that happened, was allowing him to have kind of like the final cut of, you know, his being director of this. So I think even before he had all that kind of buzz about him for Lord of the Rings, he went into this production knowing that he would be able to write the script, he would be able to direct and like have that final edit power, which is so important. Yeah, this movie came out to pretty strong, I would say, reviews from from critics. It was released around the holiday time. It was, I want to say, the best-selling movie of that holiday season. I'm pretty astounded looking at Rotten Tomatoes. It has an 84%. It's certified fresh by critics. The audience score right now, Miles, is only 50% for this movie.
Really?
Doesn't that seem so low?
I am guessing it's the length.
Yeah, yeah, it's an issue. There are a 250,000 reviews, so you got people from probably all over reviewing it. On Metacritic, the audience and critic score are basically the same. It's like an 81 and an 8.0 for the user score. That's only that's about like a tenth, or no, it's like a ton less reviews. There's only 629 Metacritic reviews, so maybe that's just because there's not as many people using that site. But yeah, I was pretty astounded by how low it is. Critics were pretty positive. I think this movie is, like you said, getting more of a critical eye applied to it. Retroactively, there was a retrospective from Den of Geek in 2017 that the title said Peter Jackson's King Kong was a beautiful, messy tragedy. I don't know about that, but and why,
as in the movie itself is a tragedy, or is the movie like themes tragedy?
I think it is the genre of tragedy. Yeah. Wired review, the title was, quote, King Kong is way long, which is pretty funny. Not a super long legacy for this film. There were some jokes on the DVD about Peter Jackson immediately going into production on Son of Kong, which is hilarious. But there is an amazing, from what I've been told, I think I played it once, but amazing video game tie-in for this movie in a time when I don't think they were super popular video game tie-ins.
I remember this very vividly because this was also the demo that all of the 360 kiosks had on it. When the 360 was coming out, this was one of the games that was, I think, at EB Games and GameStops that were like showcasing what the 360, the next generation of consoles could do, because the 360 came out before the PS3. And I remember being blown away because it was like the sequence that you had in the demo, like had a lot of rain and lightning effects, and you controlled Kong. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, oh, this is awesome. Like, this is such a cool like improvement upon the prior generation, which is the last time I think I've really felt that in terms of generational video games. But yeah, I absolutely remember this video game being kind of a moment in time.
It had original dialogue from the film. There was dialogue in the video game that was recorded for the film, but didn't make it into the final cut of the film. So you're getting almost like an extended cut of the movie by playing this game in some ways. And yeah, it's so crazy. You have the original voice actors do voices here and there, and supposedly played very well, so is highly regarded as one of the best kaiju video games. And it's one of those things where you can tell that they were the company that created it was like, you know, working hand in hand with Weta, with the folks behind the movie. So pretty cool. I gotta say, I like to see it. Are you ready to get to rating this one, Miles?
I am.
Do you want to talk about your personal enjoyment? How you like this film?
Yeah, it's a little bit frustrating to rate this one because, you know, one, everyone knows, not a Kong guy, not a giant ape guy.
You are a Peter Jackson fellow.
I am a Peter Jackson guy.
Okay.
So here's the thing for me in terms of my personal enjoyment. This movie is so close. I mean, this movie flies so close to the sun. This movie is so close to being an absolute masterpiece. Like, there are things that keep it from being an absolute masterpiece, but there are many times, especially in the first half of this movie, where I just was thinking to myself, this is exactly what I would want a King Kong movie to be. I want this great adaptation of the 1933 story done in the best possible maximum budget, big stars, but done seriously, done reverently. And Peter Jackson does do that. That said, this movie is a little overbloated. It doesn't land all of its emotional beats. And especially with that Beauty Killed the Beast line. And it doesn't always know what to do with its characters. Conversely, the main character of Andero is fantastic as the heart and soul of the human side of the story. And Kong is perfect in every way. Despite the fact that there are things that don't completely work for me. I can't give this a 10 as a result, but I'm giving it a 9 because I think this movie is certainly an achievement. And Peter Jackson's love is very evident in this movie. He cared very deeply. We can see that on screen, probably too much. This movie certainly needed a little trimming and a little more TLC in certain areas. But I think this movie is a tremendous achievement. It's an excellent film and certainly one that everyone should see.
Yes. And I'll take a step further. When they re-release this next year, probably for the 20th anniversary, if you are a kaiju fan, I think you should see this. Treat yourself. See this on the big screen if you haven't already.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I think this is one of those experiences, once in a lifetime, seeing this in the movie theater that will allow you to fully appreciate this. I think this is a 10 out of 10 personal enjoyment on the big screen. Like, if you are dedicating yourself to going to the theater, if you're ready for the 3-hour engagement, then you're going to have a good time. That said, my rewatch of this, I don't think I've seen it all the way through since the theater as well. But I mean, to be honest, probably the same way with the Lord of the Rings movies. I'll catch bits and pieces of them. But since I watched the extended DVDs of those movies, I don't think I go back and rewatch them very, very often. They're great. They are like 10 out of 10 experiences.
Oh, yeah. The extended editions of Lord of the Rings are 10 out of 10, 100%.
They're so good. They're actually re-releasing them. I'm really debating going and watching all three of them.
I might do that as well. Like, I've got the extended series set on Blu-ray, which is apparently still the preferred one above the 4K.
I've watched all the special effects making of documentaries.
Yeah,
other DVDs.
We did a series rewatch like about 2 years ago, and I'm it's always a series that like I'm never like, oh, you want to watch Lord of the Rings? Cool, I'm down. Like, yeah. It's one of those. Yeah, I love it. It's so good.
But like I said, I think if they did that to this movie, put it on the big screen again, I would probably go. And I think you should too. That being said, watching it at home, I was checking my watch all the time. I was looking at the time because I was like, I knew this is 3 hours, but it feels so much longer in times.
It does feel its length. And that's the big problem.
The movie is 84 minutes longer than the original. 84 minutes and maybe a good...
Almost an entire movie long. Well, it is an entire movie longer.
Yeah, it's an entire film. But I think about half of that extra time, maybe 30 or 40 minutes, is actually earned. And then the other half, maybe not so much. I think there's a lot that could have been cut and left for an extended version. Like, I feel like if the extended version had been an hour longer, it probably would have sold more. Just it being 13 or 14 minutes longer is not that much. But yeah, still, this is an amazing, fun, emotionally bits, you know, film. I think it does the emotionality of the Kong story better than 76's Kong. I feel like it does some of the action adventure so much better than the 1933 Kong. That being said, it is not perfect. It's not my favorite. I'm giving it a 9 out of 10 as well, Miles. And also a 9 out of 10 for the technical aspects. I really think this movie was a huge achievement in 2005. And in theaters, like we said, I was just blown away by the special effects. Mm-hmm. I feel like Peter Jackson did a great service to this movie in waiting 7 years or whatever to bring this to the big screen, because he had access to so much more technology and technical know-how after doing the Lord of the Rings. especially with the motion capture of Andy Serkis, that this movie is a million times better than it would have been if he had made it in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, like we said, that some of those elements, those green screen elements, just do not kind of live up to my memory of them. And we didn't mention it yet, but we talked about it off air. The effect, this choppy slowdown that happens throughout the movie, where things kind of go in slow motion and we get like 10 frames a second for like this weird,
yes, this
weird effect. Happens multiple times. It happens like when when Driscoll is like typing on the typewriter.
It happens with the skulls on the walls. This was something I was about to bring up in my technical thing too, so
sorry I stole your thunder there.
You're fine.
Terrible. It feels like a PS2 cutscene is happening. I hate it every time. It's the worst. I mean that alone is enough to drop it a point, but yeah, 9 out of 10, because there are some elements that by today's standard are just hard to watch. But what about you?
Yeah, so that you just said right there about those shots, they feel like they come straight from the late 90s. And it makes sense that Jackson came from independent film. There's a string of these kind of like wannabe auteurs inspired by Tarantino that had stories that were solid on screen. I mean, they're good movies, but like they're very film bro-y. Your Tenth and Wolfs, your Pool Hall Junkies, but they all had this kind of shot in them where you have like these quick cuts of like you're going towards something, but it's like you said, like 10 frames a second, boom, 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 as you get close to it. Each one's kind of a flash and it's like slow-mo, and then it gets super grainy when you get a close-up. And he does that here almost 8 years later, and everything else in this movie looks drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, we're getting into the HD era, and then he pulls this nonsense, and it takes you out of the movie. It severely annoyed me, even though it happens like three times, and it's like mostly in the first half of the movie.
Yeah, I think it is kind of only in the first half.
I don't want to mark this movie too harshly, because even though the script does kind of fail its ensemble, and even though the "You Killed the Beast" line rings so hollow and unearned at the end of the movie, it doesn't take away from the fact that this movie is brilliantly cast. The special effects are state of the art. Kong has never looked better at this point in time in history, and by doing so, expresses exactly what Kong is supposed to express. And Darrow is fleshed out to perfection. Wonderfully played by Naomi Watts. I think here the good outweighs the bad. Yes, I would have probably cut about half an hour from this movie just to clip it along better. If this movie was 3 hours long and it had stuff that was fleshing things out and moving things along, like the Lord of the Rings movies, where those movies might be 3 hours long and sometimes they feel 3 hours long, but it's 3 hours long of like great, consistently great stuff. And I believe there are one or two of those shots that I was talking about, or that we both have reference to in those. I think with the Nazgul, I think they use that shot at some point, that weird 10 frames per second shot. So despite the fact that I do have some issues, there is so much this movie does that is state of the art, next level, pushing kaiju cinema into a new dimension, that I can't be too harsh on it. So it's certainly not getting a perfect score, but I'm not going to even ding it down to an 8. So I'm also going to give it a 9.
Okay. Yeah. It's kind of where I figured we'd both land thereabouts. All right. We're tied so far. Maybe we'll go into this final one as well. For its importance, I'm giving it a 10 out of 10. I think this King Kong movie probably did as much for kaiju cinema as the original 33 King Kong. It was an inspiration. It showed that Hollywood can make a great CGI effects driven kaiju film. It really wipes a lot of the taste of Godzilla's 1998 entry. And, you know, in a world where even Japanese daikaiju had gone out of fashion, in the Millennium Pictures having, you know, returns at the box office that were depreciating each film, this is one of those films that, you know, Yoshimitsu Banno probably saw and inspired him to go to producer Brian Rogers in 2007, a couple years after this movie, and start the process of an American company taking a crack at Godzilla. They shopped it around a whole bunch starting in 2007, 2008. Yeah, I think this is a movie that's a reaction to that. I think that we're going to talk about it in a little while, but this is a kind of film that maybe inspired J.J. Abrams to go the opposite direction in Cloverfield. Instead of having a loving, humanized kaiju protagonist/antagonist, we get like a horrible alien bottom dweller in his film. I think this movie really stands up with the original King Kong in such a way that 19 years later, when we're talking about it right now, this is, I feel like, a start of a new era of kaiju films. You know, last time was like one of the last instances of Godzilla in a guy in a suit for Godzilla. And this is this is 1 year after Godzilla Final Wars and puts us in a whole new headspace of what kaiju movies can be. So, yeah, I'm giving it a 10 out of 10 for its importance. And like I said, this is a perfect 10 out of 10 for Peter Jackson. This is the movie that he wanted to make, and it's perfect to him. But I think this is the only 10 I'm giving it. What about you, Miles?
So I don't quite see the movie as in terms of importance the same way you do, because I do think this absolutely has an influence, and I do think that it does help start conversations. I absolutely believe that is true. That said, it's a very slow crawl to get, like, it takes over a decade for it to really get to the point where things are moving again. Because it doesn't even really fully start with 2014s. It really kind of starts with King of the Monsters, was where the ball is starting to really roll for me. But this is certainly the catalyst. I do think this is probably the definitive version, despite my problems with it. I think this probably is the definitive version of seeing King Kong. I think I agree with you. Jackson went out to make the movie that he wanted to make, and it is, by and large, a phenomenal expression of this story. So while I don't land as heavy on the importance, it's still pretty high up there. So I'm going for a 9 out of 10.
All right, 9 across the board for you. I'm giving a 9.3 out of 10. Brings our final podcast total to a very simple 9 out of 10. And, you know, historically, that is whereabouts we've landed on King Kong films. That's what we gave the original King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also the 76. No,
I thought I was a
76 was an 8 out of 10. Yeah,
I thought it was an 8.
Slightly less. And I think that stands up. I think if any King Kong movie could get a 10 out of 10, it would be this one. It's hard to imagine them making it even better, but I guess it's possible. Maybe we'll get another.
Well, and solo, I mean,
King Kong film.
This version of the story was so strong that when they even rebooted Kong for the MonsterVerse, they didn't remake King Kong.
Yeah, I will say I do. I'm Skull Island.
Oh, we'll get there recently.
It's so good. It's actually very close to a 10 out of 10 for me as well.
Oh, no, I love Skull Island. We'll talk about that down the line.
Because I didn't love it when I originally watched it. I actually didn't see it in theater, but kind of wish I did. Yeah. I remember, we should have seen it together, because I think you had just came up to
Boston. I was in town. We talked about seeing that, because that was the month. That was a weird month, because like Power Rangers came out, Logan came out, Beauty and the Beast came out, like a ton of things came out at the same time that March. And yeah, I was towards the end of the month. We had talked about seeing Kong. You're right.
We really should have it. It's so good.
Yeah,
but yeah, not a remake of the original. It's like its own thing. But that is technically like the origin Kong movie for the MonsterVerse Kong, even though it could have been just like a different giant ape in that same universe and it would have been fine. But
so
that's gonna do it for a look at Peter Jackson's King Kong. 9 out of 10. Folks, you can find us on our social medias online, listed at Kaiju Versus History on your Twitters and things like that. Email us at kaijuversushistory@gmail.com. We've not gotten an email in a little bit, but if you want it read on the air, if you have a question, we will respond. It might take a little while, but check out our Letterboxd account where you can see all of our reviews. You can see our watch list for upcoming stuff if you want to watch along with us. And yeah, let us know what you think of the podcast by rating, reviewing, commenting on episodes wherever you find them. And tell your friends if they like Kaiju. Miles, what are we doing next week?
All right. Well, thank you, Patrick, and thank you, listeners. And we're going to catch you next time. We move from the one and only King of the Jungle to another monarch who's king of nowhere, and a movie that you will likely have never heard of. That's right. Tune in next week when we start the odyssey of the Asylum films on this podcast as we begrudgingly get into History versus King of the Lost World.